Well, when I'm teaching the college kids about life as an investor, I try to teach them a little bit about life as a person in the hopes that they'll create some perspective about some of the things that are going to happen to them and the decisions they're going to make and how much luck there is in life. I remember one time I left the fraternity, I had a choice. I thought, God, a hamburger really sounds good. And there was also a street dance going on just up the street from the fraternity, and I decided I'd go hang. I wasn't going to dance, of course, but I was going to watch a little bit. And doggone it, if I didn't meet the woman who I then married. And so, you know, that's a random event. And so there's good luck in life, there's bad luck in life, but we got to remember that it's not all about our talent. Sometimes it is just this wonderful thing that happens to you. And one day, Tom called me and wanted to come over and talk to me because he had, where he was working at a radio station, and he thought that our firm could spend some money on some ads. And he came over and we talked, and I probably could have gone out for a hamburger instead, but it changed my life, and I had an opportunity to work with one of the nicest people I know. What I did for him was teach him about investing. What he did for me was teach me all about podcasting, and we worked together on the radio. He was the boss. I was just there to educate and to teach. And so today, Tom has agreed to sit here with me for a few minutes and talk about some of the things that he's working on, because he left the firm where we were working together, started his own firm with Don McDonald. Many of you know Don and Tom from Talking Real Money on the radio and on the internet. But he started his own firm, built it up to be very, very big. I don't know how much money they have under management. How much money under management?
Well, company-wide, it's about $3.5 billion. This office is about $800 million.
That's terrific.
Thank you.
And so he was the principal of Vestry, but now he's the regional director of a company called Appella Wealth. And I am thrilled. I mean it this time. I have said that many times about being with you, but this time I really am thrilled to be here.
Thank you. No, I mean that truly is meaningful. But when you tell the story, I think you probably should have had the hamburger rather than having me come over. But that's a whole other thing. So,
well,
kidding aside, it's great.
I'll tell you what I love. I've been out of the business basically for about 10 years. And so this gives me a chance to kind of ask about what's going on inside the business.
Well, you're inside it right now.
I know.
So you can look around. You can steal from my desk if you want.
Your office is much bigger than mine was. And by the way, neat.
Okay.
That'll become a shock to my wife, I'm sure. Anyway, I have some questions about young investors, about how we can teach investors the important aspects of investing. And I also want to talk about people, because I get a lot of people who contact me and want to know how to get in this industry. So let me start out with a real easy one.
Okay, give me the softball.
All right, this is softball.
Yeah.
So the key, I think, for people to be successful as an investor, obviously they need to understand how investing works. But it's the expectations that they create about what's going to happen to their investment. And, of course, you and I know there's a lot of randomness that goes on in the returns that we get. But what do you do to create reasonable expectations in the hopes that people will stay the course?
Yeah, I think that's great because, you know, a lot of people call us who've looked at their returns and said, shouldn't I be making more? It's a fascinating thing. I mean, well, this year, I mean, the NASDAQ's up, you know, like 20%. Why am I only up 5%? Well, I don't know. What do you own? I mean, how much do you have in stocks? How much do you have in bonds? What are you trying to make? What did you tell your advisor? How much did you tell them? How much risk, how much volatility are you willing to accept? And what sort of money are you trying to make? Those things should be looked at first. But in terms of expectations, I think that's a wonderful question because my expectations are high. I mean, as you know, I'm kind of an optimist. I kind of, you know, things are going to be great in the future. They're not always great, right? And there's bad years. I mean, certainly 2022 was very difficult with stocks and bonds going down. So I, number one, I think going back to what you said about people sort of at being a good investor, pardon me, part one is you got to be, people have to understand you've got to save and probably save more than you want to save, right? Because most people think, put a little bit of money away, it'll grow, I'll be rich, it'll be okay. You're going to need to save more than probably what you want. And I think the biggest thing, Paul, for young people is the minute they get any income to understand to take 20% of that and put it away.
Wow, 20.
I generally tell people 15, but I feel like 20 is a better number. You know, like yeah. That should just go. I mean, and that's not money you're thinking about for a house or car or anything, or wedding, any of those things. That's just gone. And then number two, the toughest part, as you know, in this business is the longevity. Looking at saying, well, over a long period of time, you can expect 5-6%. I think people often think, well, the market goes up 10% a year. Yeah, very few people make 10% for one thing. Very few of them make it. I think if you looked at the market, how many years has it actually gone up 10%? I mean, over the last 100, not very many where it's been actually 10. And then you got to learn to live with the disappointment that 1 out of 4 years, basically, it's a down year. I mean, that's going to happen, right? I think truly the more important thing we can teach people is the stock market is not a gambling casino. What it is, it's a measure of businesses. And some days those businesses look great. Things are going to go well for whatever reason. And some days they don't look great. And so it's sort of a measurement of that rather than I'm throwing my money in hoping for the best. You do have to be an optimist. You do have to believe in kind of capitalism in a way because that's what it's a measure of. And then you have to be patient. We know. We just know because we see it all the time from people that bailed out in the spring of 2020 or bailed out in the spring of 2001. I mean, we're right when it just looks tough and then whoosh, market goes right back up and costs them a lot of money. So, yeah, longevity, I think, and just being willing to have the proper perspective that this is all about patience. Yeah. You just have to be willing to take the good, the bad, and the ugly, and sort of look it in the eye and say, I'm going to hang in there because better times are coming.
Yeah, and that 1 out of 4 years that you mentioned, people also need to know, and this is a new study I just saw, that since 1927, there have been 145 decades, if you will, 10-year periods, that the S&P 500 lost money.
And people would never believe that, I think, if you told them. Nope.
Exactly. Mm-mm. And now a lot of those were overlapping periods.
And you say it's 10 years, then you add a new month, it's 10 years, yeah, so it's rolling.
But it was a big deal when from 2000 to 2009, there was, they called it the lost decade.
Sure.
So lost decades are not unheard of. And over the years, how many folks have you run into that are willing to sit in an asset class and be willing, and particularly if it's the only one they've got?
Yeah.
And willing to stay the course, even though there's all this history of success. Well, it's also got a long history of failure for short periods of time. But 10 years to many of us, well, to me, I'm almost 80. That's a long time.
It is a long time. I mean, so you're right. This is what I find, by the way, is if people are properly diversified, they don't tend to look at each asset class. They tend to look at kind of, the market feels like this, feels like that. Where am I and all that? What's the benchmark? Because people ask me about benchmarks all the time. I go, how are you invested? What is your benchmark? But you raise the S&P 500, which I think today more and more money's piling into that because it's had this huge run, which I think is a huge mistake because we know that after things have a tendency to go straight up, they have a tendency to go the other direction. And yet human nature is, it'll just recency bias kicks in and it's going to keep on trucking. So that's a mistake. But how often do they bail? You know, often, I think the bigger one is, frankly, between stocks and bonds, where young people will invest in stocks for a few years, the market will go down, and they say it doesn't work. They'll then move money into bonds, for example. Those don't make any money. They think, what am I doing wrong here? I thought I was supposed to save and invest. And yeah, you've got to teach people to sort of avert their eyes, get on with it, and keep saving. You know, frankly, and I've talked about this publicly, I look at my 401k twice a year. You know, I put it in a spreadsheet twice a year just to see, you know, kind of generally. But I don't get up every morning and go, "How? Yesterday was a big day. How much did I make?" Because I think that leads to bad behavior. Sort of watching it on a regular basis will make you do things you don't want to do. I'll put it that way.
So talking about young investors, give us some tips that would be good that a parent or grandparent could pass on to that first-time investor. That would be the kind of tip that would serve them for the rest of their life.
Yeah, I mean, number one, we already talked about that, saving something. I mean, from the honestly, my now 15-year-old daughter has a pretty good-sized Roth IRA. She's worked for her mom for the last 3 or 4 years, been putting money away in the Roth IRA. So, and it she hasn't been doing it, but we have. The money's been going in there. Number two, I think she's in one or two funds. Keeping it simple. I mean, I just ran across somebody who's in their late 30s. They have an advisor at a major brokerage, all these funds. It's complicated. I said, you don't need that. You just need a globally diversified stock fund. In this case, it's the Avantis Global Fund, which has a sort of leaning, if you will, to small and to value. Then I put her in a target date fund for the rest of it, added in small cap value. That's it. It's relatively simple. And it's also low cost, which is another thing that the advisor at the major brokerage apparently didn't care about because they're in funds that are almost a 1% expense ratio,
wow,
which is outrageous when you're 39 years old. Don't need all that. Don't really need an advisor. Just need to be saving. You know, and then the other part of all this is figuring out a way to keep your hands off the money. I mean, we've all been in these situations where it's like, I got a problem. I got to get it some money somewhere. You got to figure out how to get around that without raiding your 401k. Or if you move jobs, I'll just take that as a check. I can go spend it now. Figure out that note, that money is truly for my future. Those are hard things because life, as you talked about at the beginning of this, doesn't go in a straight line. It does zig and zag and things are look like it's going to go this way. No, it went back that way. So those, I think it's saving something, investing properly, and being able to leave that money alone when it feels like I really want to have that money because I need it for X.
Now you've been then a teaching parent, and I'm going to guess that your kids, in fact, you've got a son who's in the business with you. I mean, that's a over the top teaching, and I'm thrilled for you because I've had a son in the business.
Absolutely.
With me, and
enjoyed working with Jeff. Of course,
it's a wonderful thing to do, but your youth, your parents, did you get an education about investing from your?
No. I mean, number one thing, while there was at my dinner table growing up, it was a competitive conversation, but it was about politics and things of the day. Money was one of those things he just didn't really want to talk about. It's just something, it's not polite. You don't bring that up. And frankly, my dad and mom, I think later in their life, admitted they weren't really savers, but what saved them was buying a home for less than it was probably worth at the time. And it went up dramatically and sold it 15 or 16 years later for many, many times what they'd pay for it. And that became the nest egg, even though my father had Social Security and his military pension. So they had that money, which they never really spent, frankly, the rest of their lives, and then divvied it up among four children later. Even though, again, I had urged my mother to spend my mom, bless her. She wouldn't even, I think the year or two before she died, she wouldn't buy a toaster because she didn't think she had the money. I said, I think you can afford this. But that was a Depression era mentality kind of thing, like, no, I shouldn't spend it. But no, that we did not have a financial education. And I'm trying to think back. I mean, I had a little bit in college because there was a guy that I knew there that worked for an insurance company that was recruiting me and was telling me about what they believed about it in investing. And then, frankly, the only other education I got was in the media business where we put the business radio network on the air. And I started learning that from osmosis, from hearing things and talking to people and interviewing them. And you were one of those. So that's really where my education started.
Sometimes parents may not teach investing lessons, but sometimes parents, they act in a way, for example, I don't know whether your mother and your father were savers or spenders generally, But when we see that, it has an impact, I think, on us.
Yeah, and, I mean, no different than turning out the lights and you doing all those little things that preserve money. They were very frugal. They were, part of the greatest generation surviving the Great Depression, of course, and World War II, and some very, very difficult times that I don't think, frankly, my kids would even have any idea to recognize today. Yeah. And today it's, you know, how many times a week will I go out for dinner? I mean, it's just a whole different. So we laugh and talk about how my dad with roast beef, for example, used to cut it so you could hold it up to the light and see through it. I mean, it was just like, wow, that's a great piece. But that was definitely, and had the same pair of tennis shoes for 30 odd years. I mean, things like that he did not, and bought in very cheap, literally cheap cars, because he just liked the fact that he could write a check and have the car, and that was that. Didn't have a payment. No, there was very much that aspect of it, but not the investing side. So you're right, they're money lessons, I would say. And another one, frankly, that my dad used to compliment me regularly on, when I went to college, and it was not an inexpensive school, private school, which I never really thought about. It turned out I ended up at that school because so many people at my high school ended up going there. And I was kind of like, well, they're going there, I'll go there too. But my dad used to compliment me regularly because even though I was involved in soccer, you mentioned fraternity, I was president of my fraternity, did all those things. I worked the whole time. I worked at a radio station there and made the money. And my dad was very proud of the fact that I contributed. I paid sort of those other out-of-pocket expenses that, as you know, do add up. And so I'm kind of proud of that because that was something he used to regularly tell me, thank you for working there and adding in a couple bucks. So
that's great. That is wonderful. Okay. Now I want to ask about your practice a little bit because I'm interested in your attitudes about what you do for your clients.
Sure.
So somebody comes to you with enough money to meet whatever the minimum is that you will work with. And having been in the business, I know if that minimum is too low that you'll get too many clients and you can't service them right. You'd like to, but you can't do it. So you have this minimum, but they have money elsewhere. I mean, they can meet the minimum, but they have money elsewhere, like in a 401k or maybe they have their spouse has a 403b. How do you work that as an investment advisor? Do you charge them for all of the money that they have under your both under your management and you're giving them
held away assets?
Held away. Yeah, right.
No, the short answer is no. I'm not comfortable doing that either, by the way. We only charge for the money we actually manage. And every client that we work with has a financial plan, because that's at the center of anything. That has to be the starting point in any relationship. Frankly, if you're working with an advisor who hasn't put that plan together, in today's world, I don't think that you're not getting treated properly. Number two, most of the clients we've done a close look at their taxation situation. So we have software now. We put it all in there and say, yeah, it really makes sense to do this Roth conversion, whatever it is. That's important as well. And then the third part of all this is that I think is horrible in American industry in general is service. We call you back. We email. We're on it. It's not like calling your bank and then them telling you they'll call you back in 4 hours. I mean, we have a team approach. So you have an advisor, you have another advisor there. If you can't reach those people, you have a service team. I just think in today's world, if you're a registered investment advisor, that's the kind of thing you should be offering. In addition to the portfolio management, which, as you know, has continued to change, because back when you and I started in the late 90s, we used to use, I thought it was like 18 funds from Dimensional Fund. I mean, remember, it was a whole long list of all those asset classes. Well, those are, of course, now exchange traded funds. There's fewer of them. They have core funds, so it's a little easier to manage. That sort of thing. The buying and selling of all that is zero now. In the old days, we were paying, I think it was $20 a trade. So all that continues to change as well, and should, with anybody you're working with. That's part of being in business. That should be better and better and better for people in today's world. Lower and lower cost and ease of use. So yeah, the practice, I mean, it continues to evolve. I think, Paul, frankly, the biggest change is the people that are taking care of you are looking at it, and I hate this word because it is overused, holistic. I mean, it really looks at your whole life, and the money is certainly part of it. The all those things. But the aspect at the end of the day is you have a plan. That person makes you stick to the plan, and you go on with it. So I think that's the biggest part of all of this.
You know, that's an interesting comment, because I think if you interviewed somebody who didn't have an advisor and asked them what was the important thing that they were going to get from that advisor, they ask a question typically that gives away how they feel. Do you think I'll make enough extra money to pay for the cost of the service, thinking that what they're really paying for is the money management?
Yeah.
But the reality is they're paying actually to maintain a discipline that most people, and we know this from the Dalbar study and other studies, that people do not get the returns of the market because they don't have the discipline in most cases. And by the way, there are lots of do-it-yourself investors who do. But I kind of relate it to a part of the world that I know well, and that is people who are overweight. And I'm not making fun of them.
Please don't pick on me right here on the show. Come on.
But I know how easy it is. But do I have the discipline to do it? No.
Yeah.
Which is why I, too, have an investment advisor.
Yeah.
I do not want to have to deal with all those decisions. They take care of it. And like you say, from when we were first started the company back in 1983, the business has changed so much.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And by the way, back to the cost of all this, I mean, the one study that I look at is Vanguard's own study. They're the king of do-it-yourselfers, and they say if you have the right advisor, right asset allocation, keeping the discipline, avoiding the behavioral mistakes which come up regularly, it adds somewhere like 3% a year. I mean, it's a big deal. But can people do this on their own? Absolutely. Run into them on a regular basis. They listen to your podcast, this podcast. They listen to mine. They're out there, and God bless them. I think it's great. I have an advisor because I don't want to mess it up. And I mean, I'll give you an example. Right now, I'm in the market for a car. I got to get a car because my youngest is going to be driving here soon. And I've been out looking around trying to think about what I should buy, because in today's world, you can spend a whole lot of money on an EV. And I talked to my advisor about that, and she's saying, yeah, maybe you should think about this instead, because this is a big fork in the road. So things like that, I think a good advisor, really can help you out.
That's great. Robo-advisors, kind of in between the do-it-yourself and the private management. What do you think about? Maybe not all of our listeners know what robo-advisors are doing. So comment about how it works and what you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, a robo-advisor is simply an asset allocator that's rebalancing. I mean, at the end of the day, the money's going in. It's in the hopefully the right portfolio. That would be part one, because you'd have to go see how much in U.S., how much in international. There's the number of questions we get about how soon do you guys get rid of this international stuff? It's underperformed really since the Great Recession of 08, 09. You don't want to own that anymore. Well, actually, I prefer to own assets that are out of favor, sir, because generally those outperform the other ones. But that's a whole separate discussion. So a good robo-advisor is going to have proper asset allocation. They're going to be using instruments that are very low cost. The charge that they're going to have for you should be very low, because there's no real personal service to this at all. And then they're going to be rebalancing those assets as needed and on a regular basis. That's great. I mean, for a lot of people, that's sure that works. I don't hear about them as much as I used to, because it seemed like when that came along, what, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago, that was going to be a big deal. That was going to change the industry. That hasn't happened. I would say that most people still prefer to have an advisor, a human being that they can call and talk to. It's a relationship in many ways. Although I do tell people, not all of them, some of them are my friends, that that should be a business relationship, right? It is a business relationship in a lot of ways. But a robo doesn't give you that, doesn't answer those questions, doesn't help you in times of distress, market downturns. I mean, certainly the spring, as I mentioned, of 2020, when The market was down, but almost 30% in a very short period of time. And a lot of people bailed out because we've never had this before, right? And well, yeah, we kind of did 100 years ago, but that's another, I mean, we could argue about that. But so, but do I think for some people, robo is fine? Absolutely. I think it'll work. And I think for younger people, especially who are starting or have some assets who are adding regularly, robo can be a great solution for them.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the industry and getting into it. We have lots of people who want to know, how can I become an advisor? A lot of them are in their 50s. In fact, I've talked to people in their 60s. They've had a great career somewhere else. They love the idea of giving others investment advice. And there are so many sources of good investment advice today. It's not impossible that you could get a decent education and be able to help those that don't understand. So they're trying to figure out, what are the steps to get into this industry? And of course, at the other end of the spectrum, we have kids who are coming out of college. I teach a class at Western on a quarterly basis, and there are a number of those kids that want to get into this industry. How should a person plan? Whether they're 22 or they're 62, you said.
Really old. First of all, anybody who wants my job to manage Don McDonald, call me. You can have it tomorrow. That goes without saying. Terrific salary. The benefits are fantastic. You just got to keep Don from getting out of his cage from time to time. All kidding aside, I mean, for young people, it's great today because, frankly, you can go to a school, university, where you can get your certified financial planner designation, basically, other than the practicum and I think the final test. That's it. So, in fact, our company has a program where they take young people in, I think at 18 or 19, you work there, you go through the whole thing, and then you graduate and you got a job. I mean, those opportunities exist. And this industry is short people. All these old guys like me are like, you know, how long do I just sit around and read a book and sit on a beach? I mean, there's a lot of people like us that are quitting, baby boomers that are getting out. So there's a lot of opportunity there. So I think for a young person, it's wide open. When you start to get to people 40, 50, and 60, it's a different situation, right? Because to make a career change, because I've got a number of people that would say, I'd want to be an advisor tomorrow, but they're making 200 grand at a decent job today. How do they move from making 200 grand to 100 grand? That's one thing you got to figure out, how to do that. Number two, you're going to find a fairly unique situation for a firm that's going to say, I'll take you on, you go get your Series 65, and then you'll have to study to get the CFP, et cetera, and become a real advisor. That takes a little bit of a leap of faith of the firm because there's risk of doing that. Personally, I think, and you and I talked about this before we recorded the podcast, that the best way, if you're, again, 40, 50, 60, it would be to get the 65, study on how to be a planner, per se, and then do your own thing. Hang out your own shingle. Be a planner. The world needs more paraplanners, too, that actually write these financial plans, work with advisors, and then you learn the business a little bit. You work your way into it to where either you have your big enough practice. There's a lot of lifestyle practices out there where people manage 30, 40, 50 million. They've got, you know, 30, 40, 50 clients, and that's it. It's a good deal. You go golfing. You don't worry about the day-to-day. You know, you don't worry about payroll and paying the rent and all the rest of that stuff because it's you. That's probably the best way. Although I will still say, if I was, again, 40, 50, 60, and I was looking for a job, I think those jobs are out there. I think you go to RIAs, you start knocking on doors and say, here's who I am. Here's my strengths. Here's the things I've done in my career. I think I could help people. And I think those opportunities exist. Harder to do it that way. I'll put it that way.
So a young person that can go through this training program you're talking about, and I assume you're talking about the Appella organization across the
country.
That's
correct, yep.
How many offices do they
have? I think
it's
only one right now that does that. This is a firm that we acquired recently that had that program in place.
Okay.
And I think it's a wonderful program. So,
and what part of the country are they in?
They're in Southern California.
Okay.
So
that's great.
We're, you know, now with Seattle's weather, we're in Southern California too. All kidding aside, that would be the way to do it. But that's the thing. You got to wake up at 18 and say, I want to be a financial advisor. I mean, I still think most people believe if you went and asked 100 Americans and said, what about being a financial advisor? Their response is, I don't want to sell people stuff. I don't want to be in a position where I got to convince somebody to do this, this, or this, or I don't want to pick stocks, because most people still think I'm a stockbroker. If I go to a cocktail party and say, hi, I'm Tom Blau, they're going to say, oh, you're a stockbroker. Well, you know, not really. I'm a registered investment advisor. I got fiduciary responsibility. None of that matters. All they think is you're selling stuff to people. You're a stock jockey. And I don't ever want to do that. We have to educate young people that that's not what the business is. It's caring about people. It's knowing, yes, about the financial side, but it's being willing to take people's problems on in many ways and say, here's how we can kind of fix that. We make it better. I'm here for you every day to make your life, to improve your life. We've got, as an industry, we have to sell that to people.
And I think a good point there is that in the personality tests that I know when I was at Merriman that they were giving, one of the comments was the people that really fit being a good advisor looked like a nurse.
Yeah, I believe it. Sure.
And I thought that was interesting. And I'll share.
Well, I'm hoping I look like a nurse every day, but that's a whole other thing, I guess. So.
Well, I haven't talked to your friends lately, but we'll have to check into that.
Yeah.
But I do have a story, because you know this lady, Cheryl Curran.
Absolutely.
Cheryl Curran.
By the way, I just ran into her at a grocery store. That's no joke, literally. I'm looking at this woman like, that looks like Cheryl Curran, who is an advisor with us at Paul's Company. And I kept thinking, is that Cheryl? Why would she be? It was a remote place. And it turned out it was. We had a great conversation. But go ahead.
Well, she was working with our firm in the back office administratively.
Right. Yeah.
And we didn't have any investment advisors at that point. And my son and I said, well, would you like to be an investment advisor? And she had worked at a brokerage company in the back office. And she said, no way. I don't want to be a salesperson.
I know those guys. Yep. Right.
I know what they're like.
Yep.
And so we said, you will never have to sell.
Yeah.
And she turned out to be a powerhouse advisor.
I can remember the day, one of the client events we had with a lot of clients there, 200 or 250. And we were introducing every advisor, this. And we said, Cheryl, and the place erupted in applause, because she truly cared about her clients.
Yeah.
They truly loved her as a result of that connection that she had with them. Yeah, that's the kind of person we're looking for. And I don't think Cheryl would be the kind would be, you know, worried about markets or all the rest of that. She's worried about you. The focus is on you and making sure your life is good. And she, absolutely. That's the kind of person we need.
Well, I am certainly happy to have spent part of my career with you in the industry, and a part of my life with you outside of the industry. And I think you're doing a great job of educating, you and Don. I listen to, not all, you know, every day there's something going on.
I know.
I have to work to get one out a week. And I think you guys are.
Well, that's because I got Don. If I didn't have Don, we wouldn't be doing five a week.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'd be like you. I'd be doing one or two a week, and that would be that. And they wouldn't be as polished and clean as the work he does.
He does a terrific
job. He makes them sound, he's always made us sound bigger. And I don't mean that bigger, like holding the middle of my stomach, bigger than what we were. He was a genius at that.
Yeah.
The podcast is, I think for him, is truly a labor of love. He loves doing it. And you would be surprised the number of people that listen to it regularly and hang on every word. They call me up. Hey, what about? And they always know stuff about my personal life. I'm like, well, how did you? Oh, that's right. We talked about it on the podcast. So Don's he's a genius at that.
He's a good guy.
Yeah.
Tom, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing some of your time and for doing so much honorable educational work. Keep up the good work.
Well, before we go, I do want to say you are an inspiration. You are a friend, and I'm lucky to have you in my life. I truly believe that. So,
thank you very much. Thanks for listening, and we'll be talking to you soon. We've got some really great stuff coming up here in a few weeks. We've got on October 11, we'll be doing the New York City AAII, which will be a Zoom presentation, an hour out of me, an hour out of Chris Pedersen, a lot of new work that we'll be sharing. So I hope you'll sign up for that. And if you're going to be there at the Boglehead Conference on the 13th through the 15th on the East Coast. I'll be there live making a actually three presentations there, or a couple of panels and a personal presentation. And then, by the way, all of those are going to be archived. All of those presentations, J.L. Collins, Bill Bernstein, a whole bunch of really, I just think, terrific. Mike Piper. So we'll hopefully you'll either come and see those or you'll come to New York with us on Zoom. But we're here to try to help educate investors take care of their financial future. Thank you.